going to actually focus more on public policy approaches in sort of the classic sense. I'm going to avoid using the term disparity because I don't like it. I think that we pretty much all agree that our goal is not to even up disease, because that would be easy. We could probably get the pork commission and cigarette companies to help us do that, and we could just hand out to those folks who have health privilege right now and make sure they had more pork chops and more cigarettes and just even it up. But I think we're trying to go for a different look. We're trying to figure out how we have healthy outcomes for everyone, as Dr. Gilson talked about. In 1982, my grandfather died of a heart attack. He died in Harlem Hospital. And part of what happened was he was taken to the hospital by my grandmother. He sat in the hospital for 26 hours before anyone had a chance to look at him. Now, there are all kinds of reasons why he died, and chances are it was his first heart attack that we knew of. Chances are he may have survived, obviously, if he had care. But obviously, it's a complicated question, right? The doctor who finally got a chance to see him burst into tears, you know, because she was so frustrated and so overwrought and just felt like, oh, my God, you know, this is what happens because of where I am and where this is. And she was a good person who was committed to working in that kind of community, you know, with those few resources. My grandfather could have ate a whole lot better. He was... you know, typical of a West Indian man who ate a lot of red meat and a lot of fat and a lot of stuff, right, that he shouldn't eat. Didn't exercise very much, worked really hard. He was a tailor, sewed for a living, like many of the folks in my family. But the story of how this happens and how it happens for many of us, or even how we have the sort of life course, right? We talk about life course epidemiology and generations of health, is bound up more in public policy than we tend to talk about. Because the way that we normally approach it as public health folks is we want to know more about the life of the people who are affected. And so we try to just focus in with, well, let's figure out how to get more culturally competent around the view of the people who are the quote-unquote victims. And so we want to do studies that help us understand, say, what teenagers of Mexican descent in L.A. do versus Cuban Americans in Miami do, which is all critical and all important. But what I want to talk about today as we think about public policy is how we shift the lens and look at the institutions. So Dr. Garza had his tips earlier, and I was like, yes, that's exactly in terms of what we do at the Praxis Project. We're a public policy shop. We're focused on community action around changing public policy. And in a little bit, I'll share some resources. So as we think about the data we collect, which is a part of the policy that many of us control, we often know more about, like, how many kids in Oakland use inhalers than we know about what kind of pollution is in the air and who does it. We know more about what kinds of kids are admitted to the hospital than whether or not the hospital has linguistic resources. There's no place you can go and, like, push a button and see what hospitals do what. That doesn't make sense if we're talking about trying to build those gaps and thinking about what kind of policies make sense. And beyond data, even when we talk about institutional focus, we often focus on institutions that provide healthcare services as the main focus of institutional change to close these gaps. So we often look at practitioners and what they're doing and what they're saying. Again, because a lot of times that's the next step up. We haven't gone very far upstream. So here we are first at the victims, and we go the next step up. Well, who's talking to the victims, and what are they thinking, and what are they saying? All that's important, but it's not enough in terms of how we think and begin to bridge public policy. So I want to suggest for the rest of my short time a little bit of what I think we might want to shift to in terms of a public policy framework. And I want to start by saying that many of the things I'm going to suggest are already in practice in other parts of the world. But because we have this weird public conversation, not here at APHA, but other places, that makes it difficult to talk about the rest of the world, especially a certain island down below us. and what they do, then it's hard to sometimes have these conversations. So one thing is that we know, because just about all of us here are down with social determinants, we totally get that it's more than health, that these issues, as folks have been talking about, the intersection of housing and income and even political participation, which is actually even more important, we're finding in the data, than many of the other things that we thought in terms of social determinants of health. We know those are critical. So then what does that look like in terms of comprehensive health interventions? And I'm actually going to focus on public policy more than sort of private corporate actors, just because of time, because there's and because there's enough that government can do and they're supposed to or ought to. So one is that our government, like many countries in Europe and in India, should actually track the racial and, I would add, class and gender and other kinds of equity impact of their decision making. Because we need to get a sense of how groups are privileged or harmed over time. And it doesn't make sense that those things aren't tracked. And they can be, and there are models for that. And so at the local level, at the state level, there ought to be an equity impact statement, like an environmental impact statement, that assesses, just like you, when you pass a law, you have to look at whether it's constitutional, you have to look at all these other questions, how much is it going to cost? Folks should also look at the equity impact, and we should track that over time. And actually, there is a tool on our website, thepraxisproject.org, called an equity impact statement tool that folks can adapt for local governments. In the U.S., because we're largely ignorant of these patterns of privilege and harm, it's hard for us to have conversations about health equity, because it gets caught up in this totally bizarre conversation that we have around affirmative action, where there's no history, where the past doesn't matter, and where the patterns aren't clear. So we need to have those, that kind of information over time and localized. Two, there has to be coordinated effort to fix the effects of bad public policies of the past. Like, our government at the federal, state, and local level have complete amnesia around the negative impact of public policies of the past and very little responsibility or accountability for fixing it. Going back as far as restoring land, which, you know, that's a hard conversation people don't want to have, but the truth of the matter is there's a lot of problems we wouldn't have if certain folks had paid people for the land that they took. Right? Paid people for the wages that they for the labor that they took. And so how do we begin to fix that, and how do we begin to look at public policy that repairs the damage of the bad public policies of the past? And some of these policies aren't even 150 years old or 200 years old. Some of them are much more modern and much more recent that we still haven't fixed. And so one of the big steps for us and many of us in local government is to step back and say, how can we as government at least fix the harm we've caused? And that would go a long way in addressing some of the social determinants gaps. So we're looking at, in fact, the Associated Press about 3 years ago did a series that looked at how state governments in the South particularly were accomplices and, in fact, passed policies to defraud people from land in the 1900s. Right, and so, in fact, the state of Alabama issued an apology, but it's not the same as getting your land back. So, it's like, you know, so this is like very recent, less than 50 years ago in some cases. And then one of the other things, and these are all, and actually all that I'm raising are actually part of human rights standards, many of which are part of the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, which the U.S. is actually up around their evaluation right now. In fact, next month in Geneva, the commission that evaluates countries, the U.S. is up for that, and there's a number of groups, I think some of them who are here, that are filing what they call shadow reports to talk about some of the ways in which the U.S. is not following through on its obligations around the convention. And if you want to know more about the convention, there's some on our website and also the U.S. Human Rights Network. But we have to act to ensure that all that government does in the present is basically at a high standard of equity and a high standard that provides access for all. You know, given this nation's diversity, every single public agency ought to have culturally competent, community competent training. You know, from the person who's the President of the United States to the person who hands you the stamps, they need to know something about the people they serve as part of their training. And that doesn't seem like a lot to ask. And that we also need to look at how do we engage the big institutions like public education, the places that we depend on to become equalizing factors, which are, we know now, not equal at all. Not in funding, not in access, not in any of those kinds of things. So, sort of in closing, some real quick thoughts and how do we get there? Obviously, broad strokes. Obviously, we have to think more like organizers than like practitioners or academicians. We have to think when we're doing our research, who is the audience? Not just us, but who are the people who make decisions? How do we talk to them? How do we change up who those folks are? How do we think of do a power analysis that helps us look at how to shift? Because if you think that some of the folks who write the stuff that oppose what we're writing are not thinking about who's reading it and how to make decisions about who ought to be in that commission and who ought to approve that, we have to be the same kind of politicians around those things and think about the power and think about how we move some of our people into those places. And we have to engage the public conversation more and be willing to put our work out there in popular ways so people actually talk about what it is that we're talking about. So we have to think about how do we move the conversation from opportunity to outcomes. We want to have standards of measurement for how this health equality looks like. Opportunity is not enough. As my mother says, you have an opportunity to sit down, the opportunity to stand up. But if you, it's whether or not you're sitting or standing that matters, right? And so we need a basic set of measures. And then we also, last but not least, in terms of the healthcare conversation, we have to get to a place where we do not accept insurance as the same as access. That we can't have a public conversation about healthcare and people talk about insurance as if it's the same thing, because we know it's not. And so we have, these are the kinds of things that we have to constantly question and raise, and as from our places, as legitimate scholars, as folks with letters behind our names, how do we get into the fray so that this conversation isn't just about what happens in rooms like this, but that people are talking about this as they go to vote, especially as we go into next year. Thanks.